Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health. You are listening to Into the Fold, the Hawk Foundation podcast. The Hawk Foundation is a mental health grant-making foundation based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about the history of the Hawk Foundation, as well as our grant programs, visit us at www.hogg.utexas.edu. For this episode, we thought that we would try an experiment. We are going to be revisiting our earliest episode on transition age youth. The subject of that episode was LaQuentin Wagner of Texas Network of Youth Services, or TNOYS, a grantee of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health. We thought that we would just take this opportunity to resurface an earlier episode in light of the modest gains that we have made in our understanding of how to do podcasts, but also because in light of the recent, or I should say, just undertaken overhauling of the Texas foster care system, we thought that that this first episode, which was recorded back in mid-2014, was newly relevant once again. For this episode, not only will you be hearing a substantial portion of the interview with LaQuentin, but as well Elizabeth Flint, who is also affiliated with TNOYS, will be adding some of her own perspective on the issues that currently confront transition age youth. So just to refresh your memory, or for those who haven't had the chance to check it out yet, LaQuentin Wagner, at the time of our interview, was a youth advocate for TNOYS. And he had some pretty, what I thought at the time and still think is, a pretty compelling insight about the challenges for those who are aging out of the foster care system, as he did, as well as, you know, everything that is involved with, you know, going from a recipient of services, as he was, to, you know, someone who has the ability to advocate for himself, as he eventually learned to do. Now, I have not been able to get a hold of LaQuentin lately, and he seems to have since fallen off the grid. However, Mr. Wagner, if you're out there anywhere, we would sure love to hear from you for no other reason than so that you can let us know how you're doing. So, without further ado, here is our revisit or refresh of Episode 1, Youth in Transition. So my first question is, first of all, how did you first come to be involved with our friends at TNOYS, and what's the extent of your work with them?
Ultimately, it boils down to getting out there and advocating. Initially, I didn't know what I was doing. I kind of was just taking opportunities that were coming at me. Opportunities started flowing when I spoke at the retirement ceremony for my old foster care case manager. Mm-hmm. He ended up being head of child placement in Region 7, so he got to know a lot of people. And in turn, my being associated with him allowed me to get to know a lot more people. And met Duncan Cormier at TNOYS through one of my random advocacy moments, and it kind of took off from there. I think the extent of what I'm doing with TNOYS at the moment is basically on the youth leadership and advocacy front. Kind of branching out now, doing a little more. Mm-hmm. But my experience as a former foster youth and juvenile justice delinquent, whatever you call it, kind of gave me the medium that was needed to, you know, do the work that I'm doing now.
Now I only just recently became familiar with the term, transition age youth. Mm.
And as you know, as a way of designating, you know, the population of young people that that Tinoise advocates for, what does that term mean to you? And if you don't, and what are you transitioning to?
Well, I mean, transitioning kind of it really depends on the youth and what their situation is in care. My personal situation was such that there really wasn't much transitioning. It was more whatever happens, happens. We hope that you make it. And if not, well, who cares? So that's basically what it was like with me. The actual transition process for me really was, you know, from, you know, having no support system, having, you know, really no life basis whatsoever, not knowing what I'm supposed to do with my life, becoming sure of myself, not so afraid of people, gaining an education, which I had lacked, and trying to not be a statistic of the foster care system. Transition. I mean, everyone's got a transition period in their life. You know, your late teens. You know, it makes the challenges, you know, it makes it that much more challenging, rather, you know, when you don't have a family behind you, don't have a means of, you know, making the education happen for yourself. Don't have a means of getting a job or keeping one. No transportation, you know, no one to call on when, you know, that transition period comes.
So, I mean, you know, our friends at Tinoise, they think pretty highly of you and your work. In fact, inspirational is a word that's been used. So, I mean, giving you a chance to toot your own horn just a little bit. So what are the assets that, you know, that you bring to your work as an advocate for youth, you know, who have lived in foster care?
The biggest asset that I bring to the table is, you know, the fact that statistically I'm not supposed to be here under any circumstances. It was not expected that I would ever be where I'm at now. I'm supposed to be either in prison, homeless, or dead. That's where most of the people that I know who have gone through the same situation that me have ended up. I think that's ultimately what really, you know, is inspiring about my situation is, you know, keeping my mind through it all and trying to be a upstanding citizen. And thus far, I've been pretty successful in that.
Yeah.
That doesn't really happen that often. Another thing would be, you know, I'm a living example of, you know, statistics not being, you know, necessarily the end all. Yeah.
You mentioned your time in juvenile justice.
Yes, I did.
Now, I mean, what experiences from that time were key in making you who you are, and how do they give you purpose?
As a whole, I think the whole juvenile situation was, it's never a good thing, but for me, it was. Yeah. You know, I had people enter my life that actually, you know, cared about me.
Really?
I know there's a lot of horror stories about the juvenile justice system, but most of my horror stories comes from my adoptive household. So that, I guess that made juvie seem, you know, that much less, you know, of a struggle. But I really did come across people who truly cared about, you know, where I ended up and, you know, what happened with my life. And that was the biggest change that happened for me. To this day, I still have, you know, friends that I met in, you know, the juvenile facilities and group homes I was in. I keep in contact with about five of the people that were staff at the facilities that I was at. And they've been a massive support system to me. That would be the biggest change for me. I think a lot of kids in juvie don't want to focus on, you know, anything other than, you know, they're in lockup and, you know, can't do anything with their lives really. But if they were to really focus on it, they'd find at least one person that, you know, would be a good influence for their life.
So you're based in Austin, but I understand that, you know, that your youth engagement work has taken you to some different places around the country, if I'm not mistaken. You know, so you can talk about some of those experiences and just what you've learned from them.
Oh, I've had around the state thus far. I've had opportunities to go outside of the state. I haven't taken them yet because I had a bunch of other things going on in my life at that point, you know, school, going to college.
Well, you know, Texas is a small country.
You're right.
Some people's opinion. So maybe that's good enough.
the reason why I'm back in Austin, because I got adopted to Michigan.
Yeah.
Back in Austin because I found my biological family. The last 5 years, it's been kind of, I've been kind of preoccupied with school and getting my life together and then getting to know my biological family.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had a lot of opportunities I turned down strictly because I'm, you know, I'm really trying to build my life up as best I can.
Yeah.
And traveling outside of the state wasn't really an option at that point. So I hope eventually I'll be able to get, you know, more of those opportunities start flowing back to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they will.
So what new things have you learned while working with the Houston Tay project?
I learned that everything isn't as simple as you think it is. I also learned that people in these industries, if you want to call them, aren't mm-hmm. evil. For the longest, I had a lot of anger towards people who ran these industries,
mm-hmm.
you know, thinking that, you know, it was all about money. And even though that may be partially true, there's a lot of really good people out there trying to do the best they can in a broken system. I've learned that there's a lot of good things happening. I specifically like that they're involving youth who have aged out of care, just mm-hmm. aging out of care. That's helped a lot of those kids. I can see how it's helping them to, you know, feel more confident about themselves, like they have something to offer to the world. I really like that. I wish I would have had those opportunities when I was just aging out.
So now you've had some experience with the mental health system also. Is there anything that, you know, that you can say about that, either, you know, positive or negative?
I mean, not much positive, honestly. I think the big issue is, I mean, you have foster kids, you know, who are being put on medications that they really don't need, you know, and I don't think that's ever going to really end.
Right.
But, I mean, it is an issue that needs to be addressed if any change for that is ever going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the extent of my experience comes from, you know, being a foster kid, you know, and having my anger issues and outbursts and, you know, issues that came from the abuses that I went through. You know, the way they handled it literally was giving me medication.
Mm-hmm.
So if I started acting worse, they just upped the dosage, or added another medication to my roster, mm-hmm. meds I was taking. So, you know, I think that's got to change. It really does. That can't be the first and last thing that everyone goes to help these kids out. There's a lot more involved, you know, with why they're acting the way they're acting, then, you know, a chemical imbalance.
Right. Okay, so you mentioned your anger. And I can only imagine that, at least at one point in your life, that you found that a real challenge, you know, to deal with. Let's just say maybe at one point in your life that your anger, you know, got the better of you more often than not. So, I mean, aside from medication, you know, I mean, what have you found to be, I guess, you know, the most effective treatment for, you know, for dealing with that?
I think the period in my life.
Just what has made it, you know, a bit less of an adversary in the present compared to the past?
Well, the period in my life where I had the most anger was, you know, in my juvenile justice years. You know, their way of punishing you wasn't really physical. It was more emotional. So if ever I did something they deemed was wrong, they took away what amounted to be my coping skills. You know, mm-hmm. They felt that at the time, I wasn't even really listening to music on the radio. I was listening to a lot of classical music. Writing a lot of music. I'm pretty good at that. I'm not talking just lyrics. I'm talking about music notes on paper.
Oh, really?
I'm a huge, huge music person. And I love to read. I was a massive, massive reader back in the day. And, you know, they would take these things that were helping me get through every day away from me and leave me in a room with nothing but white walls. And, I mean, that's where my anger came in the most, because I felt like I was losing my mind at that point. So ultimately, it came down to my coping skills. I had things, you know, that I had to help me cope, and the things they were suggesting, you know, counting sheep or, you know, counting my breaths or whatever, none of that worked. Really, the measure of punishment that they had for me is what was causing my anger outburst the most. Mm-hmm. Music has always calmed me, so that's the first thing I pretty much run to whenever I'm feeling really, yeah. I love to sing and I love to write, so those are the two things that I run to the most.
A naive person hearing that, you know, might, and that's, I guess, before you've had any time to elaborate, would just sort of assume that it's, as for most people, just something you really, really like. But from what I'm hearing, it goes a little bit deeper than that.
Yeah. It's always gone deeper than that for me and my siblings. You know, we devoted ourselves entirely to music, really. We didn't get into songwriting until we were in our teens. Mm-hmm. But singing is all, we were able to sing way before we were able to talk. You know, that's just something that, you know, came naturally to us in our biological families. But it really did become a coping mechanism, you know, through all the things that we were going through in our adoptive household.
Yeah.
So, it goes way, way deeper than just a love or a like for music. Music was a lifeline.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess I'm allowed one cliche question. Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Or if that's something you've thought at all about?
I mean, I think about it, but I haven't been able to come up with an answer. I think that probably has to do a lot with, you know, what I've been through in my life. You know? I've had so many, you know, this is something I'm struggling with now. Out of everything that I've been through, I'm struggling a lot with, you know, the things that I missed out on, the things that I lost coming up. Music, mm-hmm. I was a couple months away from going to a music academy, which potentially could have changed my entire life. Mm-hmm. And that opportunity was ripped out from underneath me when I went to juvie. So for me, at this point, I've had so many lost dreams, mm-hmm. you know, and that I really don't see too much of, you know, what could happen. I'm kind of taking it day by day.
Do you mind me asking how it is that you wound up in juvie?
That's a really long and complicated answer.
Well.
Long story short, I tried to report abuse in my adoptive household. It didn't go very well, and mm-hmm. instead my adoptive mother counter-accused, and I was the one that, yeah.
Okay.
So that's ultimately what happened.
Okay. So, wow, I see a second cliche question here. if you could meet your 17-year-old self, or your younger self, let's just say, what advice would you give to him?
Well, I mean, it'd have to be before 17, because by the time I was 17, I was really hell-bent on not becoming a foster care statistic.
Yeah.
So I was doing everything in my power to, you know, not become that.
Yeah.
So even though I have made some wrong decisions from 17 on, mm-hmm. I don't regret or fault those decisions because they were made with the best intentions.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to say it'd be between the ages of 14 and 16 that I would want to, you know, speak to. And I would probably tell myself that, first I would say what's going on now. You know, this is what's in your future. This is what's going to be happening. So you really don't need to stress about, you know, this is all your life is going to be. Therefore, you don't have to be so angry about everything.
Right.
Because ultimately what it boiled down to, my anger was that I felt like this was, you know, my life. This is what it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not see an end, no matter how hard I tried, to everything I was going through.
Yeah.
And that ultimately made me, you know, rage filled.
Now, what do you think about, I guess, the role of the parents in transition age youth?
Wow. Well, that's a complicated question because it really, I guess, question would need more clarification. I guess I'll just run down the list. I mean, you see how it happens with biological kids.
Yeah.
You know, their parents, for the most part, are there for them through everything, you know. And the most they have to worry about is getting drunk at college, you know.
Right.
But adoptive parents, I've heard some good stories. I've seen some good stories.
Yeah.
A few.
Yeah.
Very few. But, any parent, adoptive, foster, they should all be entering this thing from a parent perspective as if this is your kid that you birthed.
Yeah.
Everything that you want to see happen for your kid, you should want to see happen for any kid that you've decided to bring under your wing.
Right.
So really, I would say it everyone's role, parent-wise, should be exactly the same.
Yeah.
And there should be no difference whatsoever.
Right.
So I think that's the best answer I can give.
Okay. So you've done work with transition age youth in both Houston and Austin, yeah, right? Is there any like differences between the two communities that you've noticed?
Well, firstly, they've got a great meeting place for aged out youth in Houston.
Yeah.
Hay Center.
Mm-hmm.
And they meet there all the time. So they've got a big, massive support system, and they know where to go when I need to speak to somebody who's been through the same thing or is going through the same thing. I don't think they have that here in Austin, you know. So if they did, I don't know how I missed it. I mean, it sounds like they've got a lot going on there that they, you know, that they're really aiming to, you know, help these youth who are aging out, at least a lot more than here in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of youth who have aged out here and are aging out, and they're kind of doing it on their own.
Right.
You know, and they don't know where to go to find other people who are going through the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's a pretty big indication that we just don't have that kind of support system in Austin that they do over there in Houston. And then the Youth Leadership Council there, the youth are way more involved than here.
Mm-hmm.
Like now they're given an opportunity for one of the youth to actually help direct the meetings. They don't do that here at all. They're a lot more involved with trying to get the youth into other advocacy things that
mm-hmm.
here they're just really not that interested in doing. So, yeah.
Okay, so now this may just be a hypothesis of mine, but I wonder if a big part of finding your voice is kind of learning to assert yourself, you know, even if against adults, experts who may want to speak on your behalf. And I was just wondering just, you know, how true that is. And if there have been moments in your life where you've ever found yourself kind of having to push back, even against those who, you know, claim to have your best interests at heart, that if that's ever happened.
I mean, I would say that's happened a lot, honestly. Yeah. I can't really say even the most well. I was just about to say even the most well-intentioned, you know,
yeah,
ends up making decisions that aren't the best for you, you know. But I think ultimately it comes down to there's a different view of youth who are in foster care and youth who have had failed adoptions than there is for youth who, you know, grow up in, you know, their household and their family, you know, and that alone makes the decisions that they make a little, you know, less well-intentioned, I guess, than the decisions that are made for youth who, you know, grow up with their families.
Right.
So for everything to be really, you know, honestly and truly well-intentioned and work out better, you got to start thinking about youth and care a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
Realize that they're, you know, they're kids too.
Trying to get away from all the serious stuff. what would you say is the most enjoyable thing in your life presently? Whether it has anything to do with, you know, the very real and important work that you're doing or not.
I love my relationship I'm in. That's nice. that's something for the most part is, you know, it's a lot more stable than I give it credit for. And I think, you know, a lot of the issues that I have from that come from, you know, not having any stability and any realness in my life
mm-hmm.
to date, really. So just, you know, that's something I love being in every day, all day.
how old a relationship are we talking about?
It's new. Really? Well, as far as the intimate part of it, that's very new. But the relationship itself as a whole
mm-hmm.
is 5 years old since I got here from Michigan. Now then I have my siblings. I had years and years where I wasn't allowed to speak to them. And now just knowing that they're back in my life to some degree, now that I can call them up at any time I get ready to, that's a really nice thing to know.
Yeah.
So I do have a support system there. I'm still getting to know biological family, kind of branching out into the, not so immediates anymore. And, you know, every day I get some sort of a request on Facebook from some cousin, aunt or uncle, you know, distant here, distant there. So that's always interesting.
We hardly touched on that, and maybe that's a whole separate episode, you know, the biological family that you just recently started to make inroads with.
Yeah.
That's, but yeah, I'm sure you're still figuring out, what that means for you. Well, okay, so let's pretend that the entire world is listening. Anything else that's been weighing on your mind about, you know, the issues that transition age youth are facing that you'd very much like for people to know about? Anything that, you know, that none of my questions covered?
With the reform going on, you know, there's a lot going on with foster care. And I think a lot of people confuse foster care and adoption or mesh them together a lot.
Yeah.
But they're really two different things. Doing a lot of research lately on cases that have become really big, for foster care abuse. And I would say all the ones that have to do with, you know, kid deaths, those tend to be pretty much actual foster care.
Mm-hmm.
But then the abuse ones. Like, they have a very infamous case, 2002, where four African-American boys were found, like, very, very, very starved.
Mm-hmm.
A 19-year-old was, like, 49 pounds. The 20-year-old was, the 10-year-old was 20 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, very, very, very malnourished and, I mean, near death. And they toted that case around, you know, foster care, foster care, foster parents this, foster parents that. But then you do a little research and you find out those kids had been adopted 5 years earlier. So those are now their adoptive parents.
Right.
And once you become adopted, the rules change,
right.
You know, and the, you know, the regulations change as well.
Right.
So, you know, while they were doing well in foster care, once it became adoption, everything just went downhill. And that was the exact same situation with me. So I think a lot of focus needs to be put on transition youth who are adoptees,
mm-hmm.
especially the, you know, the ones who get adopted older,
right?
Because those tend to be the ones that the adoptive relationship doesn't work out well for,
right?
And I really want to see laws change regarding getting information about biological families.
Mm-hmm.
Like my biological mother and father may not be very great, but I have a lot of cousins that would help out a lot if given the opportunity. But, you know, legally, I'm not even supposed to know who they are. They banned all information from getting to me. However, my adoptive father, through some strange twist of fate, decided to be nice and send me all of my paperwork, you know, which was highly unexpected. And that just kind of dropped everything in my lap. And, you know, that's information that I really needed because I really didn't have, you know, a support system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my adoptive family definitely will never be that. You know, I mean, well, my adoptive folks, rather, my adoptive siblings are pretty supportive for the most part, but
really?
All of us are all over the country.
Yeah.
So kind of hard to really be there for each other. But yeah, I want to see a little more care taken for the older youth who get adopted. You know, it might be in a lot of their best interest to find somebody, you know, that'll have their back, and that might just be in their biological family.
That was LaQuentin Wagner, at the time a youth consultant for Texas Network of Youth Services. This next segment is Elizabeth Flint, who is currently a youth program coordinator for TNOYS. She has been there since 2011. Among other hats that she wears, she oversees Peaks Camp, an experiential learning program for youth and adults, as well as organizes Youth in Action Capital Day, an event that brings youth to the state capitol here in Austin to advocate for policy change. And so she's going to be adding some of her own perspective. We hope you enjoy.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Flint, and I'm the Programs Coordinator for Texas Network of Youth Services. I do a lot of the youth engagement work, and I'm really happy to talk about Tinoy's youth engagement and our beliefs that the importance of youth engagement in the work that directly affects the population. We have a variety of different programs at Tinoy's that help youth like LaQuinton to gain the confidence and skills not only to talk about their own story, but also advocate for others that are in their shoes. We tend to make connections to youth who have a passion for wanting to change and taking them under our wing. In LaQuinton's case, we were able to go beyond in helping him craft his story and speak at events, but actually employ him as part-time staff through the Transition Age Youth and Families Initiative with the Hogg Foundation. This unique opportunity is where we were allowed to go in and help 8 organizations in Houston include Youth and Family Voice in their mental health services and promote collaboration among those agencies. The initiative allowed Tinoy's to have funds to employ Quentin and others along the way. He went on trips to us with Houston to hold Youth and Caregiver Council meetings as well as provider meetings. We would co-facilitate the meetings and trainings so that he was able to see all aspects of the grant, just like any other person on the Tinoy's staff. Unfortunately, he is no longer with Tinoy's in this capacity because, as we all know, life changes. With some unforeseen circumstances, he had to leave the position but is still connected to our organization in a more smaller kind of sporadic involvement. If you're involved in this work, you know the positive impact including youth voice and youth on your staff can have, but you are also aware of the challenges. Youth in transition are often enticed by the here and now and don't tend to think about life long term. And no fault of their own, their life experiences have only given them this outlook. It's hard to keep a youth position on staff employed, but I believe that it's something that every organization should strive to do. It benefits not only the feedback and kind of feedback loop for your programs, but also gives you a lot of credibility in helping other youth. We are lucky to be flexible at Tinoy's, meaning we can kind of change our meeting locations, times and days so that it fits the youth schedule, and that has really helped with our youth engagement work. We have also changed our organizational structure, making youth engagement a priority so that we can include youth trainers and co-presenters whenever we are able to. More specifically, it means we're able to carve out the extra time to help train youth and help them be more comfortable in a professional environment. Tinoy's has a variety of programs that help youth gain skills to advocate for themselves. One of our biggest is Youth in Action, where about 300 youth come and gather at the Capitol and present to their peers and legislators and legislative staffers of the area that they want to promote change. Presentations are created by the youth groups and presented by the youth groups to a variety of audience members. Topics can range from general improvement areas like community youth development to healthcare to specific bills centered around foster care, mental health, STAR funding. It's kind of endless, to be honest. We provide general training so that youth leadership and advocacy so that they feel comfortable on stage and in a room full of professionals. We also just really take the time to make sure that they have a seat at the table when dealing with things that involve them directly. I'm very grateful to work for organizations like Tinoy's and, of course, the Hogg Foundation for valuing youth as much as they do and making an effort to spread those values. Thank you.
And that does it for this episode of Into the Fold. We hope that you found this exercise in plumbing our archive to be a worthwhile one. If you are interested in anything else pertaining to the foster care system in Texas, I strongly encourage you to check out episode 27, titled, appropriately enough, Child Welfare in Texas, in which I interview F. Scott McCown, a member of our National Advisory Council and a clinical professor of law here at the University of Texas at Austin. He had a lot of really excellent information about the current state of the child welfare system in Texas as it's undergoing, as I alluded to in my intro, a pretty massive overhaul. And so if there's more that you would like to know on this issue, check out that episode. That does it. Ike Evans, Hawk Foundation for Mental Health. Thanks so much for joining us.